Hi, Dr. Bouquet.
Hello, how are you, Dr. Colette? So wonderful to be joining you in this beautiful webinar.
Thank you. I am really glad that you're here. I have to do you justice and share your amazing, a little bit of your amazing bio with the people before we jump into your journey. So, Dr. Muriel Bouquet is a first-generation Black Dominican psychologist, a world-renowned intergenerational trauma expert, and the author of the best-selling book, Break the Cycle: A Guide to Healing Intergenerational Trauma. Dr. Bouquet earned her doctorate degree in counseling psychology at my own alma mater, Columbia University, where she also trained as a fellow in holistic mental health. Noticing a huge gap in trauma-informed care and trauma-informed institutional action to address the needs of underserved communities, Dr. Bouquet developed a holistic system of care with equity and prevention at the center. That's the foundation of her consultation and therapy practice, Break the Cycle of Trauma. She's widely sought out for her clinical expertise and trauma approach, and we're excited to have her with us today. So welcome again to Cohort Sisters, and welcome to the Cohort Sisters podcast, Dr. Bouquet.
Thank you so much for this beautiful introduction and of course, for the invitations into conversation with you.
So we all know, or those who know about your amazing and impactful work. Those who don't know yet are about to find out, but we'd love to get to know you a little bit better. So can you tell us a little bit about who you were as a child and how your childhood influenced your decision to become a psychologist?
Wow, I love the start. As a child, I remember very distinctly being someone who was a very shy child, and I actually would get stories from my mother indicating that I was like really quiet, really, really shy, and that most people would be like, "Wow, you have, even a toddler. You have a toddler in your house?" Like I would never thought because it's just so quiet here. And when I became a clinician and when I was just reflecting on the ways in which I grew up and some of what I had bear witness to and the ways that I oriented around the adults around me and even some of the kids around me, I realized that I was somebody that was like an emotional sponge. So I was definitely that kid that took on a lot of the emotional energy and tension around her. And I just never really had any kind of language or understanding of what was happening in a very intuitive way, in a very, just natural way, just being like a tender kid. Now, I was also a kid that lived in two places, which I think also, kind of contributed to the shyness. I grew up for only 5 of my years in the Dominican Republic. And then I came to my hometown of Newark, New Jersey, where I was raised for the rest of my life, really. Being someone who not only was an immigrant, but someone who grew up with economic impoverishment, someone who grew up with the identities of being Black, of being a girl, of being Dominican, there were a lot of intersections that created a lot more tenderness to an already tender kid, So now, of course, I think that that's kind of like it's my gift, right? But for many of us little tender souls, whenever we don't have really people that understand it as a gift, we could kind of like even, not really find our place in the world in the ways that can be beneficial because, that tenderness can be so incredibly guiding in so many aspects of business. Of course, it has been like that North Star in my actual experience around being a psychologist, right? And specifically being a trauma psychologist. But my infancy definitely did start with a lot of tenderness.
That's really interesting. There are so many different similarities with our childhood. I also grew up in New Jersey. I lived in West Orange for a while. I also am an immigrant, so can really relate to how these intersecting immigrant narratives or immigrant identity, being a girl, an immigrant girl, like in and of itself is a whole thing. And then also growing up in an urban setting in New Jersey, I very much relate to that. I wasn't necessarily tender, but the other things, I have a similar childhood upbringing and can very much relate to some of that. I'm hearing you say that your emotional sensitivity and your emotional tenderness was kind of like really ingrained in you from a young age. What about like the academic side? Did you see people around you who were psychologists? Did you know that this was a thing that you could get a doctoral degree in? What were some of the either touch points or moments or even people who inspired you to move to the path towards getting a doctoral degree in psychology?
Would you believe that this is actually my second career? I think I'm relatively young, right? One might say I'm 28, but I spent 5 years in the infancy of my professional career within advertising and media. Part of the reason why that happened that way was because I was a journalism and media studies at Rutgers University, where I went to undergrad. I didn't really have kind of like any orientation. I was just kind of told like, be, what makes your heart happy, which is a beautiful thing that, my parents are amazing in that way. However, I just chose what my dad used to do back home. And he was a reporter, and I was like, I want to be like my dad. But I never had any role models, any kind of language that was even indicative of the fact that mental health was a thing, that mental health was an area where I could create and burgeon a career. And it wasn't until I was in the advertising landscape and two things happened. One of which was I was not very satisfied with my career. And what I did was that during my downtime, both in the evenings and on the weekends, I started volunteering back in my hometown of Newark, New Jersey. And the volunteer work, where most of the help was needed, that's where they would place you. And so I started getting placements within mental health. And I started thinking like, wow, this is a way that I can help. Oh, there's a director of mental health services inside of the institution that serves individuals that have been impacted by HIV/AIDS. And I'm working there on the weekends as a volunteer. And I'm looking at these people that have these specific careers that are in my own community that I never knew of, never, no exposure. And then simultaneously, I started going to therapy for the first time. And the therapist in my very first session said, you're very psychologically minded. Have you considered a career in psychotherapy? And so the combination of those two things happening simultaneously were what started driving me in the direction of considering this alternate path, which was not easy because that meant that I was already a career professional and making, a significant amount of money, and also, being a part matriarch of my family, of generations of my family, and having to extract myself from a professional landscape in order to go back into being a college student with a dearth of economic, as many of us know, there's a lot of economic depravity. Even with the scholarships, a lot of us don't even get the living wages that we need. I took a leap of faith and I decided to do the thing that my heart was calling to, and I've never looked back. I'm really happy at what I do.
I am so glad that you shared the aspect of your career, which I didn't realize actually that you had a career before you became a psychologist, before you became a clinician. And I think that's really relevant for a lot of people in our community because, and I don't know if people know this, but actually the age at which Black women get their doctoral degrees is on average higher than the average population. So many of us do go to a doctoral program or decide to get a degree. Well, we already have, as you've mentioned, like responsibilities, right? And so this narrative of being a young 20-something year old with no problems and responsibilities in a doctoral program who can then afford to live off of a graduate stipend, that doesn't always apply to us. And so it often kind of creates tensions or just creates additional challenges for us. There's also the community element that is really strong in many Black cultures of, really relying on all of us to contribute to the household. And so you mentioned, you said that you were a matriarch in your family, which is an interesting, I haven't heard that language used for, someone under 60, if you will. But when you think about, financial contributions, I'm like, absolutely. So I love that you brought that up. And I know that that's the reality for a lot of us in our community as well. As a Black Latina woman, what were some of the other challenges that you experienced while getting your doctoral degree? And then what were some of the successes? So I feel like we often only focus on the hard parts. So we always ask this question to kind of like force people to say something good as well as something that was difficult about the process. So we'd love to kind of know, how was your doctoral experience shaped both positively and impacted by your racial and gender identities?
Love this. So, agreed. It's very easy to go to to the stuff that was challenging. And there were many challenges. Like I even mentioned in my book, the racism and classism that was a part of the daily lived experience of being an Ivy League student, especially at a doctoral level, because as many of us know, when you're in a doctorate, you've worked so hard to get there. You have been almost kind of like indoctrinated into this system where you have to finish. There's a lot of high stakes, to completing a doctoral degree, and a lot of loops and a lot of milestones that you have to hit. And I think that that makes it all the more, it makes a person all the more vulnerable to systemic abuse and to interpersonal abuse that's sanctioned, that the system allows, right? And so there was a lot of that. I mean, one of the things that one of my professors did, which I still have in my own home, I have the actual paperwork that this person wrote into, because I think that sometimes, these things happen and you're like, did that really, like people would be like, did that really happen, girl? Like that's a little extreme, right? But this person, we have something called the comps, which is basically like after a number of years and after you've completed all of your coursework, you sit down for 2 full days to actually write down like this 20-page document of a compilation of a synthesis of all that you have learned, and you intersperse some of your clinical knowledge together with some statistical analysis, together with some neuroscientific like theories, and like you just like really bring in everything you've got into this 2-day experience. And I remember being failed by this professor because the actual language that they use was, your first paragraph was too long. And so they failed me, which was so, anyone like, listening or watching, one would be like, what? And the system allowed this? And yes, because the system would allow something like that, because the system, is not willing to disrupt the racist, classist actions that a person engages in order to maintain caste, in order to maintain their own racism and classism. And so these were the things that were a part of my full like 6 years in this institution, and having to kind of like do the silent suffering. Sometimes I did raise noise, and the raising noise actually got me in a lot of trouble. So I would be very strategic about when I would raise noise. And so these things tended to happen with frequency, enough frequency to kind of goal was to break down your soul and to make it so that you would basically drop out so that they could maintain the caste system as it's intended to be maintained. And so, then I would see a lot of my Black colleagues disappear, drop like flies. And that also is very soul draining, because you're like, where did they go? Am I next? Right? And so like there's so much that you suffer in these walls when you know that there's high stakes. You've already got tens, for me, hundreds of thousands of dollars like put into this degree, and you just can't just let all of that go because somebody, or a system is intentional about not letting you succeed. But then there were other people within these systems that they themselves actually went through a process that was similar and intentionally made it so that they could deposit into me in order to help me to get through. They brought me into one of the most beautiful experiences that I've ever had in the academy, which was a 3-year holistic mental health fellowship, in which I was such an integral part of building that fellowship, being the prime, person to actually develop the structure around the clinical practice that we would later integrate into the Columbia medical system. The person that was then appointed to provide the services in my own, it wasn't my hometown, it was Washington Heights, but I have a lot of family members that live in Washington Heights as well, so it's still my community. And to be able to see myself as like someone that was seen as of value by specific individuals that understood what it felt to feel like you were not perceived as being as smart, as valuable, as successful as your colleagues simply because of the identities you hold. I felt like those were the moments that I really held on to and gravitated towards, and those were the people that I made sure that I was in connection with every day in order to help me to reach that finish line.
That's beautiful. There are, so many people who like never find that community of people who are supportive and who are encouraging and who not only are creating like emotional safety, but are advancing them professionally, like advance, like putting you in spaces and giving you the opportunity to advance your career, your professional career. So I'm really, really glad that you were able to find that, you know, amidst the paragraph is too long drama and the many other things that I'm sure that you experience. It's just beautiful. And I think one of the main differences between, you know, folks who are able to push through what is designed to be a weeding out process and folks who are not often is like, are you able to rally around some kind of support? You need the support, you need the community. And for folks who might not have that at their institutions, that's one of the reasons why we exist. Like we can be that community for you. If you ain't got it at your school or your program, that doesn't mean that you don't, that there's no one there or there's no one out there who doesn't care about you. Like we're here. We're here to get you through and we're here to support you. So I'm really glad that you have people in your corner. And I want to talk a little bit about your career trajectory after you got your doctoral degree, or maybe that, you know, you started to have these thought processes while you were still getting your doctoral degree. But psychology is one of those fields, and there are some doctoral degrees where it's kind of clear like what you're gonna do like with your doctorate. But psychology is one where I feel like there are a couple of different tracks and a couple of different options, right? You can go into academic psychology, you can become a faculty member, you can go into clinical practice. You have kind of decided to do a variety of things. So you have your coaching, consulting business, you've got corporate training, public speaking. You know, why did you decide to pursue, you know, those options, those career options with your psychology doctorate instead of clinical practice or academic practice? Like, what were some of the factors that led to your decision to have a more coaching, consulting, writing, speaking based practice, and you're still using the same tools, obviously, but why that choose that career trajectory as opposed to an academic or a clinical career trajectory?
For me, it was simple. I just wanted to be free. Like, I didn't want to be a part of institutions that damper my soul, and then I show up to a session with a dampered soul and try and rehabilitate someone else's soul. It doesn't match. So for me, it made a lot of sense to extract myself from diseased systems and to erect systems that are decolonized. And have within them our souls and our spirits at the center. So for me, it made more sense to leave very, as the world sees them, prestigious institutional affiliations to build the prestige within my own name. And I think that, you know, that felt more aligned for me. But I also, you know, Audre Lorde like helped us understand, like, we can't disrupt from within, right? We cannot like dismantle the master's house using the master's tools. We have to erect systems that have freedom at the center. And I also want, you know, anybody that works with me within any of the corporations, the businesses that I erect, to also feel that freedom. So for me, anybody who's connected to me feels the softness that I infuse into the work. And not just that, but also the very intentional humanizing perspective that I infuse into every aspect of my business, because we matter, because I matter, because I am the people we serve, right? And so I know what it's like to feel like a clinician doesn't value you, like they don't see you as fully human, like they disregard your pain, like they just destroy any of the actual programming that can be helpful in facilitating your healing in a more comprehensive way. I've seen it all. And I don't want to be affiliated with that. I don't care what institution it is. I don't care what name they have. I'll use the name because I paid for that money. I paid for that.
I
So,
know that's right.
yeah, I'm like, y'all are expensive. You know, I'm still paying for that. So I will utilize the degree that I earned that degree 10 times harder than anybody that was in my cohort, you know, before me and after me. Like, of course, there were other individuals who shared my identities who were, you know, also had to work just as hard. But I, you know, just to use myself as an example, I worked really hard for what may 19th of 2019, because I'm only almost 5 years out, believe it or not. I worked hard to reach that day, right? So I will be, like someone who's embodying the spirit of that day and what I, managed to do to actually make it to that finish line. But then beyond that, what I wanted to do was to create spaces and be a part of spaces where ease and love and care were really burgeoning. And although I spent another year both as a professor and as a clinician in the system, I realized very quickly, only took me a year, I was like, yeah, no, I got my licensure, I'm fine. I can go and do the disrupting now, because now I have everything in place to be able to do that. So for anybody who's hoping to disrupt, I would say, of course, reach those pillars that would then allow you to then go out and disrupt. And if you don't want to reach the pillars, that's fine too. That's a very honorable journey as well. But I think that the biggest thing is preserving our own freedom and wellness, so that we can then embody that for the people we serve, but also for the people that get to be in our proximity, our family members, our friends, everybody gets to benefit from that freedom.
Yes, that is so beautiful. As you're speaking about ease and softness, I'm just imagining it must be so great to work with you. You must be just like the best boss. So I don't know if you're hiring, but if you are, let the cohort systems community know.
Yes, I will be very shortly. So probably when this comes out, I'll already start the process. And of course, it will, have a lot of heart. I believe in also, this is a matter of, I'll tell you why I'm saying this, but I believe in also being the best and being one of the best, or whatever that may mean. And in part, that came about for me because the people that I serve usually look like me, or share identities of mine, and I believe that we deserve the best quality care. And so for me, the people that I train, the people that I mentor, the people that I mentor with it organizationally, right? Because I don't have a lot of, time, but the people that I devoted to helping to also become the best, it's very intentionally, because I know that we are likely to serve our own. And if we're going to serve our own, I want it to be the best quality care that we could possibly receive, because that is what we don't tend to get and what we deserve. So yes, I am a stickler for making sure that we're well informed and that we're doing good work. But with that, I am also a stickler for how are we taking care of ourselves? How are we taking time for family? Let the pets and everybody come into these screens. Like, we don't, we decolonize in that way too. And how are we doing, and how are we communing with each other as a community? So there's all of that as
Yes, that was like much better like work with me pitch than a job description. So if anyone was on the fence about what it would be like to work with you, you've just laid it out very plainly and clearly. And I really appreciate the additional insight you shared about wanting to be excellent because we deserve that. So I think a lot of perspectives around Black excellence are rooted in a fear of like being found out that you're not good enough, or like this idea of imposter syndrome, like I have to be great because if I'm not great, then people will like think that I don't know what I'm talking about. And you kind of turned that upside its head and said, like, no, like I need to be excellent because that's what we deserve as a community. So I love, love, love that framework. I want to get a little bit into your research expertise, your specialty, which is trauma and specifically intergenerational trauma. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit on how intergenerational trauma can impact either positively or negatively someone's educational path or their career pursuit.
Yeah, that's an important piece to add to the conversation. So I appreciate you adding that. And intergenerational trauma is very insidious, right? Like, it's so incredibly, it can be so invisible in our lives because it has been normalized for just such a long time, because we just haven't had the language, the tools around it. And so it makes its way into our lives in ways that we would have never believed it could. I think one of the ways for us professionals in which it is most prominent is by way of imposter syndrome. And I always tell people, whenever imposter syndrome enters the conversation, that imposter syndrome is the intergenerational lie that we have absorbed from having been explicitly casted out of systems and out of spaces for generations. However, because no one's ever really gotten down to how we need to approach imposter syndrome, we have continued to internalize it and continue to live in this lie. When instead, what we need to do is externalize it. It's a them problem. They have not done the internal work and the external work, the systemic work, the policy work, to be able to understand the gift that it is to have a diverse environment with diverse perspectives, with diverse approaches, and have done themselves and the systems that they have erected and sustained a disservice by not having us included within them. And the byproduct of that has been that we have not seen faces that look like us in these spaces. And as a result of not seeing faces that look like us, we believe that we do not belong. When in fact, it has only been the fact that there is a lot of fear of infiltration or being taken over by dominant parties that has made it so that we haven't been present in these spaces. It isn't because we don't belong. It isn't because we are not good enough. It isn't because they're smarter than us. When in fact, many of the people that I've experienced that have marginalized identities within these spaces are some of the smartest people that I know and are actually more impressive than some of the white individuals, or at the very least, like privileged individuals by way of their multiple identities. That's perhaps one of the most important pieces of, intergenerational trauma as it makes its way into our professional environments that I want us to really hold on to and hold on to from the perspective of, this isn't my stuff. This is their stuff. This is their fear. This is their inability to let go of their perceptions of power or real power that have made it so that I have then unconsciously internalized a lie, and that we can externalize it and just push it back onto them so that we can then exist in these spaces without that heavy weight of imposter syndrome.
That's such a great example because we have this question when people join the coercive community. It's like one of the first things people see, which is like, what is the number one barrier to your success as like on your doctoral journey? And I would say like at least 10% of the responses, and there have been over 1,000 responses, but at least 10% mention imposter syndrome in some way. And sometimes there's an articulation of like, I know that I shouldn't be feeling this, but I still feel this. But I think that you're framing imposter syndrome as a form of intergenerational trauma, and also thinking about intergenerational trauma, not just something that can be like in your family or in your bloodline, but as like the generation of like academia, as like a body and the system as an institution, and the trauma that has been perpetuated and continues to be perpetuated from the system, how we sit in that. Yeah, so I think that was a really great example that's so relevant for so many of us, whether we are currently in school trying to get into a doctoral program, whether we are already finished our doctoral degree and are now navigating either academic or non-academic careers. So that's such a good example. I'm really, really glad that you shared it. Another thing I want to talk about your work is how you integrate Indigenous healing practices with therapeutic practices that are more commonly accepted or traditionally accepted by researchers and clinicians. Again, thinking about this like ivory tower, what is good or acceptable medicine versus what our communities have for centuries been using as traditional practices. And so you are really intentional about infusing both of those together and not privileging one type of clinical practice over another. What are some of like Indigenous or Black culturally rooted healing practices that doctoral students or early career scholars can take to break the cycle of intergenerational trauma, especially as it relates to, institutions of higher education, as we've been talking about?
I love this question. So just a little background, when I say Indigenous healing practices, what I'm referencing to is Indigenous to the lands that they derive from, right? Versus I think some folks might interpret that as just simply Indigenous as Indigenous people, right? But there are people that are Indigenous to lands in the continent of Africa that have specific practices that have been present for centuries, for thousands of years, that have healed an insurmountable amount of people, right? Like there's the same, with South America, right? Like there's well, the land that is now South America. So there are so many variations of that across the world that have been debunked, decontextualized, demonized, and have been not even included in the idea of healing. And for me, it has been very important to, first and foremost, like if I had a client come to me who is a working professional and is engaged in an institution where they're not feeling seen and they're like going through the generational healing process, first and foremost, I would be very curious about their own, their background, right? Like one of my best friends is both African American and Cape Verdean. From both sides, she has these beautiful indigenous to the to you know lands that are across the world, practices and ideas and rituals that are just beautiful, that are a part of what for her is important to infuse into her healing, right? So I would be, I present that very individual and very specific kind of intersection of identities because I think that that's important for me as a Black Dominican, my Blackness and the ways in which across the diaspora we have a number of different beautiful practices that are important for me to intersperse into my daily life so that I can have not only healthy racial saliency, but also a healthy connection to my racial identity. And the same with my Dominican identity, right? Like I need to, understand like how did my people, when they were transported into the Dominican Republic, find their ways into living through the land and off the land from a medicinal perspective. So all of that is just the nuances that kind of happen in the process of me like excavating like information so that I can then tailor the care and utilize it in a very specific way. But if we were to like just really kind of like more globally think about what can feel like it can be healing, I'll offer two examples, which are I think two that people may not more conventionally lean to, because of course we for example, if we're feeling depressed because we're so isolated from, where the love is, right? And we're continuously entering spaces where, they feel psychologically violent. Many of us don't lean into the practices that my fifth grade African dance teacher, Miss Barnwell, who I've been talking about her all week in like presentations. I adore this woman and I'm so glad I refound her recently. So I'm excited about
Love
that.
that.
Yeah, but I actually have been recommending to particularly to Black women and femmes, the idea of going back into, if it's just in your living room, doing some sort of movement that emulates African dance. Just pick whichever dance, there's so many, right? But just maybe like orient your dance towards that so that you can not only feel the rooted experience of being reconnected to your roots, but also the more like trauma-centered experience of releasing some of the traumatic retention that's up in your system. And so that's one of the practices that I, have been leaning towards, recommending folks of the diaspora specifically. But there's also the communal aspect of healing, right? Many of us think about, maybe gathering and like cooking a meal or like doing potlucks or things of that nature, usually when there's like a holiday or something, or maybe there's somebody's birthday, if ever, right? For the working professionals and for students, it's almost kind of non-existent. But I would urge us to reconsider how we're approaching that practice and potentially even bring in a cultural element into it. Let's all cook. Like that's why in my book at the end of it, I talk about this. It's almost like a meat stew because it's different kinds of meats in there. And we have so many variations of that across, the diaspora. There's so many.
Everyone's got a stew.
Everybody has a stew. I go to so many places and I'm like, we got this too. It's the same thing. It's wild. And we call it different things, but it's, the way that my family would make that stew is that there would be one person chopping up like the carrots and the cassava and like all the vegetation. Another person would be, extracting some of the fat from the meats. Another person would be actually like putting together all the seasonings and actually putting heat on the pot, right? And this is a beautiful moment in which, in even now in modern day society, we could still do that together as a community. And while we're doing that, we can have conversations. Girl, what happened to you in that meeting? Right? And like, how did you feel? Like, tell me about your emotions. How are you carrying that? And while we're communing over an actual meal, but also the creation of that meal that is rooted in our history and also rooted in our resistance. Because it is a part of our resistance to still be able to say, we still eat that. All of that, there's so much soul nourishment that happens in a moment like that. And it might just take one, short moment of your weekend. But the remnants of the healing that you're likely to experience from having a moment like that are so powerful. So when it comes to infusing practices that are going to be soul nourishing and holistic, some of my practices look like that. They're not just sit on that couch and come talk to me. It's not enough. It's not sufficient for the kinds of pains that we have endured generationally, but also that we continue to endure on a daily basis within these systems that continue to perpetuate pain.
Wow, I love those two examples. My brain is on fire right now because I actually really love like cooking and having people over, like I like cooking and posting. And I've never thought about it as a healing exercise until you just talked about it. But especially, adding in the component of, doing it in community with other people, I think that is just like next level. I'm about to go figure out who can I invite over next weekend to have a little cooking session. And that was just really powerful. So I'm so glad that you shared those really specific examples and examples that I don't think that we often associate with healing or with wellness and well-being. Like, right, like dance, we kind of think of maybe related to exercise, but like not really to our mental well-being. So I'm so glad that you brought those two examples up. So as we start to wind down, I want to know, what are you envisioning next in your own career trajectory? So you've had the career outside of psychology, you had the advertising and marketing career. I feel like the doctoral journey itself is a career. So you had that career as a doctoral student. You dabbled a little bit in academic medicine, and now you're doing this. So how do you envision the future of your career?
I envision it with being half of the time living on a hammock and like just having ease. I really want to create greater points of access and greater points of acceptability because some of what I have seen and found and been able to observe within my own work is that we as a community tend to self-pathologize our very own healing practices when they are regurgitated back to us because we still prioritize Western models, Western science, Western medicine, and Western ideologies. Until those very Western dynamics come in and prove to the rest of society that any one of our practices holds merit, we're not willing to buy into it. And it's really unfortunate. It's some of what happened with like yoga. We started bringing yoga into the science lab, and we're like, oh my gosh, like people's neural pathways are shifting and changing for the long term. And their, brains that are neuroplastic are now restructuring to different ways of like experiencing calm because they're in these yoga poses. Whereas before it would have been a traditionally, frowned upon kind of practice, been, seen as a spiritual practice that didn't belong anywhere else world. And so we tend to kind of only follow that process. That's why within my book, with some communities, organizations, or conversations, I can see the people that are elevating the science and talking, wanting to talk more about epigenetics and wanting to talk about indigenous practices. And my hope is that I can continue to spread the word about how we've been here and we've been doing this, we've been effective. And that I can help, especially us, the ones who have internalized those colonized ideologies, to come back home and realize that we've had the wisdom and that we can utilize the wisdom that belongs to our communities to help each other heal.
Absolutely. There's another example that came to mind that's not necessarily related to individual healing, but I have small kids, so I was thinking about baby wearing, as you've said, this like baby wearing, holding your baby, wrapping your baby around your body is something that like we've been doing forever, but like recently it became a thing that is now like wraps are so expensive, so
Wow.
expensive now. But yeah, it's just sometimes we don't really find the value of our own practices, of our own cultural traditions until they are either scientifically legitimized or adopted en masse by white folks. So I think that's such a great reminder is to, bring people back home. As you said, I love that phrasing and remind us that we have always had this knowledge. It's always been within us. It still exists. So we just have to tap into it. I love that. So we always ask every single podcast guest to reflect on this. So what is one final piece of advice that you have for Black women and non-binary doctoral students or applicants or maybe even early career scholars, especially as it relates to their career?
That the lived experience, the experiential knowledge that you have is unmatched and gold and needed and valuable. That it is part of your gift. It's your generational wisdom. It's what will transform the world. It's what we need infused in every aspect of business and every aspect of society. So please don't let the institutional violence that's present in whatever market you find your way into dull your light and your voice and your capacity to express the wisdom that we all need to hear from you.
Beautiful. Snaps. I hope that folks are snapping at home, in the office, in the chat. Thank you again so much, Dr. Bouquet, for sharing your journey and your insights with us. Please do, folks, grab your own copy of Break the Cycle. Follow Dr. Bouquet on social media and sign up for her newsletter. We are going to be dropping all of those links for you in the chat. And thank you again, Dr. Bouquet. You're such a light. You have such a calming presence through the screen. And we really appreciate having you in the Cohort Sisters podcast.
Thank you. It's been such an honor. Thank you so much for inviting me. I really, really enjoyed our conversation, and I hope that, it can reach the right hearts. So thank you.
Thank you again for listening to this week's episode of the Cohort Sisters podcast. If you are a Black woman interested in joining the Cohort Sisters membership community, or you're looking for more information on how to support or partner with Cohort Sisters, please visit our website at www.cohortsisters.com. You can also find us on all social media platforms at Cohort Sisters. Don't forget to subscribe to the Cohort Sisters podcast and leave us a quick review wherever you're listening. Thank you so much for joining us this week, and we'll catch you in next week's episode.